Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, esteemed colleagues, members of the board, local dignitaries, everyone, really, stockbrokers, dock workers, celebrities, nobodies, the newly departed, the poorly depicted people who are still teething, people who are looking for a helping verb, those drunk, the high, the blue, the down, los pueblos, los animales, foreigners, strangers, bookworms. Those whose eyes are tired from trying to read something into everything. Those at a crossroads in a crisis, a quandary, a velvety chair. The dirty, the hungry, yes, we, the cranky, the thirsty, the furious, the happy, who were filled with life. And of course, the bereaved, the bereft, and let's not forget the local merchants, the smiling faces, the placeholders, us, all of us, we the people, slowly graying, slowly leaving, who make all this possible. This activity, this festivity, this hope, this dream, friends of the deceased, the diseased, friends of the disowned, and of course, all the healthy, friendly people with great skin and congenital heart defects. Sports fans, sufferers, down and outers, non-believers, animal lovers, real people with doubts, without certainty, with nothing else worth mentioning, the majority of us, silent, stifled, delinquent in the background, barely hanging on, running out of time, hope, air, heart, nerves, chances, money, blood, friends, courage, faith, hair, time, teeth, more time, health, hope, all of it. All of those sans everything, those avec nothing, who can't stand it any longer, who never really could. Gentle, gentle people, infinitely injured people, lost souls, ghouls, ghosts, descendants, shades, shadows, future ancestors. I know I'm forgetting somebody. Hopeful people, citizens, every last lone, dying, and inconceivably lonely person, fellow human beings, breathing people, breathers, welcome. The fire exit's over there, and you can also get out that way. Well, that is the beginning of Will Eno's wonderful, memorable, disturbing play, Middletown. And Middletown was a part of the Bobbleu Theater's Reader's Theater earlier this year. If you haven't attended Bobbleu Theater productions, they're really extraordinary, and local theater deserves support. My real welcome is to all of you to the 11 o'clock service at the Foothills Unitarian Church on Memorial Sunday, the Sunday before Memorial Day. It's a real pleasure to have you here. Nice to see so many of you here today, now when you might be doing something else before the rains come. At the first service, Vicki said to me, "Have you told people why you're behaving so strangely and why this service is such a hodgepodge of all these different elements?" And I said, "No, I neglected to do that." There has to be a service when one is getting ready to retire after 23 years here and 41 years in the ministry, in which one decides to place all those parts that never fit before or never fit well and probably should have never fit well. Probably it was better to leave them all out, but there has to be a time of reckoning where they make their appearance, so that is the plan for today. Things that never should have seen the light of day on a Sunday morning in church will make an appearance and perhaps hopefully have meaning, and we'll see. People before Sunday services sometimes tell me, "I'm really looking forward to this," and I never quite know how to respond. "I hope you won't be terribly disappointed," would be one possible response. "I hope you will enjoy the experience." But year after year of expectation has never left me sanguine or overly confident, and I hope never arrogant. I have tried over the years to bring issues, ideas, content, poetry, ramblings, reflections, meditations, prayers that I intended to be of minimally interest to the congregation and hopefully more. But it is an act of daring to hope even that a Sunday service would be what? Interesting, dare we say inspiring? And of course, there are those Sunday services where I do note that people are looking at their watches, which I completely sympathize with, believe me. I just know that it is an interesting relationship, the relationship between the person here and the people there. It's intriguing, unpredictable, and it's one that I have valued over the years. Sometimes you've told me that something I have said has stayed with you and has made a difference. And of course, that's what every preacher hopes for and dreams of. Not everything connects, and that may be one of the reasons why in my services I've tended to put elements and items that may not always have cohered in the eye of the reasonable, rational person. But never having pretended to be any of those things, we always wonder what connects and what doesn't. At the end of a Sunday morning, I've always hoped that connections have been made and that something meaningful has occurred. There are announcements that are of interest to the congregation in the order of service today. A very interesting announcement from our MUMS group and from our FUYAG, our young adult group. And you'll see other announcements as well that are of interest to you. We conduct, when we do our offering a little bit later, something we call Change for Change. Coins placed in our basket help local organizations and agencies, and we'll be helping the Education and Life Training Center. But the leadership of the church proposed something that I'm very excited about, and I'm very grateful that they did, and that the congregation has responded. Beginning next year, we will be dividing our plate 50-50 with organizations that deserve our support and caring. That means that 50% of whatever we get on a Sunday morning goes to support very worthy and important organizations that are working in our own community. I think not only will we raise significantly more money for those organizations, but it's a stance that the church is taking in terms of what we do with our generosity. So I'm really proud of this congregation and very happy for you in having made that decision. I've often felt that spoken announcements, though they gain a very mixed press among clergy and congregants, spoken announcements do have their place, especially in a world where you're being inundated with written material. Your email boxes are overflowing. We are sending you, all of us, all organizations, more and more all the time, things to read. So those things to be heard might gain in importance. Well, in any case, it is a pleasure to have you here this morning. Vicki and I do have some time left with you. I will be here next Sunday on our Flower Communion Sunday. We have two services scheduled, and we do remind you to bring a cut flower if you're coming to those services. Also, we do have our open house here on June 7th, a Saturday afternoon, and many thanks to all the people who've worked so hard to bring that to be. I do need to lift up a special thanks to Lynn Young, who has worked very hard to work on not only the open house, but also many aspects of our celebration. And Lynn Young was one of the people who was on my search committee, which brought me to Fort Collins, Colorado, in 1991, as was our own Dr. Robert P. Martin. And I always will remember and treasure that time. I had been in Colorado, but not for many, many years. So it was an interesting journey from Boston's Logan Airport to DIA in 1991. And Fort Collins in 1991 is not the Fort Collins of 2014. So it was a very interesting and precious journey to me. And I know that Lynn and Bob and many others worked really hard for that transition and for bringing a new, well, at that time, the only parish minister here. It was a time I'll always remember and treasure. Something I've treasured also are years of saying church affirmations and doxologies. These tend to be said at many Unitarian Universalist congregations, and I'll invite you to stand now in body or in spirit. We will say the church affirmation and sing our doxology. Seated. Many thanks to our guest pianist, Susan Snyderman, who is here with us today, allowing Ryan Marvel to have a nice weekend break, a nice Memorial Day weekend. So, part one, can we be certain about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? It's a profound question. And for many of you who don't understand Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which is truly one of the major scientific theories of our time, let me explain it to you this way. The Cleveland Symphony Orchestra is leaving Cleveland, heading for Denver, Colorado, where they have a special engagement. What time will the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra arrive in Denver if they do not realize that this concert has been scheduled? That's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Those of you who do advanced algebra, I've worked out the equation, and I'll be happy to share it with you after the service is over. Now, some of you have felt that over the years I have shared with you some pretty awful jokes and puns. And I can't deny it. So I thought, let's just get those out of the way early in the service, and then we can go on to whatever is to follow. So I do know a guy who's addicted to brake fluid, but he says he can stop anytime. I stayed up all night to see where the sun went, and then it dawned on me. I am reading a wonderful book about anti-gravity, and I simply can't put it down. Something actually rather sad did occur. The Energizer Bunny has been arrested and charged with battery. Yes, and of course, there are the philosophical statements. Those profound statements that come from many different traditions. I've always thought of myself as a universalist, tried to draw on traditions of both West and East. So in terms of my own life and the aging process, my wild oats are mostly enjoyed these days with prunes and all bran. Just remember, it's hard to make a comeback when you haven't been anywhere. And if God wanted me to touch my toes, he would have put them on my knees. So we've gotten past those without any glimpses of cardiac arrest in the congregation so far. This is a true story from Simon Wiesenthal's autobiography. Famous Nazi hunter was pretty relentless in his search for people who had perpetrated horrific crimes, but did have a sense of humor after all was said and done. But there is a message here in this story. He tells about a time after the war when he was in a camp for displaced persons. There was a man living near him who borrowed $10 from him, and the person assured Simon Wiesenthal that he had a package coming from a relative and would positively pay him back the next week. At week's end, he had an excuse for not paying. The next week, he had another, and so it went on for many months. Finally, one day, the man did come up with a $10 bill in his hand and said to Wiesenthal, "My visa has come through. I'm leaving for Canada tomorrow. Here is the $10 I owed you." Wiesenthal waved him away and said, "No, you keep it. For $10, it's not worth my changing my opinion of you." Now, I've talked to you in the past about Nasruddin, who is a figure who appears many times in, for example, Sufi literature. He appears in a lot of the folklore of the Middle East. And so he'll be transformed from time to time into just kind of a crazy fool or a wise teacher. Or maybe there's really no difference between the two. But he appears over and over again in literature with his name spelled in different ways. So here is a spiritual story. He's walking in a bazaar with a large group of followers, and whatever Nasruddin does, his followers immediately copy. Every few steps, he stops and shakes his hands in the air and jumps up and yells, "Who? Who? Who?" And so his followers stop and do exactly the same thing. A merchant who knows him rather well quietly asks him, pulling him aside, "What are you doing, my friend, and why are these people imitating you?" "I have become a Sufi master. These are my spiritual seekers, and I am helping them reach enlightenment." "How do you know when they reach enlightenment?" "That is the easy part, really. Every morning I count them, and the ones who have left, they have reached enlightenment." Over the years, I have been an avid reader, and it is the very unusual week where I haven't made my way to the library, where, as yesterday, there are about 5 books waiting for me. 5 books go back, 5 books come out. Now, I'm not that fast a reader, so Vicki would be the first to tell you that I do not make my way through books cover to cover, but I nibble, sample, look for passages, parts that are really intriguing and interesting. And I will have to say that over the years, I've looked for essays, comments, thoughts, and ideas, phrases that are contrarian, or at least, in my own view, interesting. Because I've always felt that Sunday morning is the heart of a faith community. Or in the Jewish tradition, it could be Friday evening. Whatever is happening in a faith community, whatever else we're doing, and important things have been done here, if Sunday morning doesn't galvanize people, doesn't connect with them in some profound way, then the faith community is going to falter. That's why over the years I put a lot of emphasis and attention on what happens here on Sunday mornings. And we've changed quite a bit. Our orders of service have changed. Our music program has changed. The congregation has evolved and changed as well. Our meeting space underwent a huge transformation in 1997. We did away with the purple doors. We did away with the 3 different colors of plastic chairs, brown, white, and blue. We did away with the 1970s style wall hanging behind me. and everything was made new. Many people were involved in that building expansion, but Dr. Robert P. Martin was one of those who had a major role to play. And because Bob lived close, he was willing to come over and kind of supervise and check and see how we were doing. And I think we did really well. This place is transformed from the place that I came to in 1991, for the better, frankly. Well, in the history of ideas, there is a fellow who has written widely and in a fascinating way about the history of science, maybe because he's a professor of the history of science at Harvard University, Dr. Stephen Shapin. And there was an essay that he wrote for The New Yorker magazine in May of 2007. It's titled, What Else is New on the History of Technology? It doesn't sound, for some people, that would sound like a really engaging article, and for others of you, maybe not. But the point I would make would be that you never know where you're going to find what we might call spiritual meaning. Spiritual tales are not confined only to Scripture. They are abundant and all around us. So let me share this passage with you. In 1817, Thomas Broadwood, a vastly successful English piano manufacturer, visited Beethoven in Vienna, and shortly after sent the composer a top-of-the-line instrument. Which of these two men understood the piano better? The craftsman entrepreneur whose product adorned drawing rooms throughout Europe, or the deaf genius whose works are a glory of piano repertoire? Or, for that matter, Liszt, who later owned the same piano and could do things at the keyboard that no performer previously could? Or the curator in the museum where the piano resides today? The piano is one thing to a pianist, another to a piano tuner, another to an interior designer with no interest in music, and yet another to a child who wants to avoid practicing. Ultimately, the narrative of what kind of thing a piano is must be a story of all these uses. It's a narrative in which we turn out that we know a surprising amount about the technologies that have infiltrated our lives, and in which knowing only as much as we want and need to know about them is, in a sense, to know a lot. I think Shapin is saying something truly remarkable and interesting, and I feel it applies to the Foothills Unitarian Church. The church is one thing to its minister, another thing to its youth members, another thing to its young adults, another thing to its older members. It's one thing to the sound technicians on Sunday morning. It's another to the musicians. In fact, if you were to tell the full narrative of the Foothills Unitarian Church, you would have to tell the narrative of all of its users, all of its participants, all of the people who have come and gone over the years, all the people still here, all the people yearning to connect with each other or yearning to connect with impassioned ideas. It's like the piano. It's not just one thing. If you look at an instrument, that one, and you see just one thing, you're not discovering it in its fullness. It represents that which is right now stationary. But it can come to life in an instant. And when it comes to life, it brings such music, such power, harmony, and disharmony that it can truly be remarkable. I think that sometimes as we try to understand people in our lives or things, we miss the point. We think that we capture them in one phrase, one glimpse, one understanding, whereas, like that piano, imagine a human being and a human life. How complex we are, how we're understood differently, seen differently by different people. You looking at yourself, are you the same person you were at 20 years old? Surely not. And what about the young people here with us who can't possibly imagine what their life adventure will lead them to? We think that we can capture things easily with phrases and labels, and they always elude us appropriately. So just for your interest, a book that you might never get around to reading, The Passionate Muse by Dr. Keith Oatley, Professor Emeritus of Cognitive Psychology at the University of Toronto. What he says really is that the friendships that we have with literary characters or film characters or a favorite author, those relationships can amount to friendships that become as important as the real friendships in our lives. Now, you could look at that in two ways. You could say, ooh, I feel that's kind of creepy. Or you could say, tell me more. What happens is that we discover that people become less lonely when they watch favorite TV programs that have their favorite characters in them. In watching these programs, people in experiments feel a sense of belonging, and the programs buffer them against deteriorations of mood and from a sense of rejection that they might fear from real friends. Dr. Oatley writes, I suspect we all have favorite fictional characters, and Hollywood has traded on this idea in creating stars who are likable, even lovable, so that we like to see them over and over again and even want to be like them. Cary Grant is quoted as saying, everybody wants to be Cary Grant. Even I want to be Cary Grant. I just find it so intriguing. And I think about a few books in my life that I just go back to, if not reading them again, at least in memory. Significant books, events, persons, authors. And yes, an interesting friendship is formed. And sometimes with a literary character, we form a friendship that has depth to it, doesn't it? Because we know more about their lives than we know about the lives of truly our closest friends. Just a thought in passing. Now, nobody calls it this, so far as I can tell, the ta-chu-tu, or ta-chi-tu, or jaditu. However it's pronounced, it refers to the yin-yang symbol, so we might as well just call it the yin-yang symbol and have done with it, because in my research, I can't find that many people call it by its name. So what is the yin-yang symbol? Well, it's a symbol in Taoism. And does anybody understand Taoism? Here's a Taoist story. When it was suggested to the wren and the cicada that there are birds that fly hundreds of miles without alighting, both quickly agreed that such a thing was impossible. You and I know very well, they nodded, that the furthest one can ever get, even by the most tremendous effort, is to that elm tree over there. And even this one cannot be sure of reaching every time. Often one finds himself dragged back to earth long before one gets even there. All these stories about flying hundreds of miles at a stretch are sheer nonsense. Taoism is a faith tradition of challenge, wonder, and paradox. And the yin-yang symbol is so powerful because, to me at least, it represents reality. That is to say, it's an unadorned look at the nature of life itself. There is a black hemisphere and a white hemisphere, and they're not either good or bad. You and I live in the Western world in societies where there are dichotomies, good, bad, right, wrong, love, hate, darkness, light. The yin-yang symbol tends to suggest something different, because within that wheel, these two hemispheres are continually connected with each other, always touching on each other, and in fact, in one hemisphere, the other takes up residence. So within the white hemisphere, there's a touch, a dot, of black. Within the black hemisphere, always the dot and touch of white. You can't imagine a human life, though we would like to, and we keep trying to, and we keep believing that this would be possible. You can't imagine a human life that would just have one of those hemispheres represented. This is the myth that we keep pushing for. I'm going to have a life that's entirely happy, white, bright, cheerful, and let me see if I can do it. Well, you can't, and you shouldn't try, because that's not what a human life is. A human life is the full circle. It's both symbols. It's both yin and yang. To imagine being able to live without both of them together, constantly touching, reaching, and connecting, is to imagine a life that is not a human life, but in fact a fantasy. The power of the Taoist symbol of yin-yang is to say that, like it or not, this is the nature of unity. This is the nature of reality and truth. And this is what our lives are like. And in Taoism, of course, a famous phrase that I've always sought to suggest is very appropriate for Unitarian Universalists. The Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. The God that can be named and tamed and claimed is not the eternal God. The God that is my good buddy and that will save me from a tornado or cancer is not the eternal God. The God that can be named like the Tao is not the eternal Tao or God. Just so we make sure that we are being true universalists this morning, let's visit for just one second the writing of Frederick Buechner, who's a Presbyterian minister, an author, a theologian. His autobiography, The Sacred Journey, has this passage. Some 50 years ago, on some July or August day at dusk, I raced as a child through fireflies across a green lawn, and in some way, with the insight of a child, sensed that that moment would never cease. What was true in my childhood belief, that each of our times goes on forever, was that once a moment has come into being, its having beenness is beyond any power in heaven or earth, in life or death, to touch. What I knew then, without knowing that I knew, was that to see the dusk, the fireflies, the green lawn in their truth and fullness is to see them already clothed with timelessness, already freighted with all the eons still to come, during which they and everything else that ever was will continue eternally to be what has been, part of the wholeness and truth of eternity itself. I wonder if you've had such a moment. If I were to ask you to conjure up a moment in your life which was absolutely eternal, which you knew beyond any quibbling or debate was going to stand in your consciousness as long as you drew breath, transforming, sustaining, uplifting, upholding, usually. These are moments where we say to ourselves, whatever else happens in my life, it's never going to be better than this moment. And until we end our life, I believe we can recall those moments when we are feeling abandoned or lost or hurting, to recall that moment of firefly and dusk, or dancing by the ocean, or loving someone so deeply it hurts. Those moments are with us, can be forever. We simply need to claim them and never forget them, and without embarrassment, hold on. So we want to make sure that we hear from Piper Brown and her wonderful presentation of Hallelujah. So I think I have like 3 minutes to explain the Kabbalah, which is the entire mystical tradition within Judaism. But I think we can give it a shot. Now, here's the problem. For those people who studied Kabbalah, which is Jewish mysticism, there were real warnings and admonitions, because as you study the essence of God, which is what every mystical tradition is called upon to do, you have to be really careful, because bad things can happen to good mystics. For example, you can go crazy. You can become a heretic because it's just too much. You can just give up the whole mission and become the manager of a hedge fund. You know, there are all kinds of possibilities. So that's why 17th century rabbis finally legislated that Kabbalah or mysticism could be studied only by married men over 40 who were also scholars of Torah and Talmud. They apparently were never acquainted with the reality of the midlife crisis. But I have been, so I just see these 40-year-old married rabbis buying a Maserati and just kind of losing it all. But that's not in Scripture, so that's just in the imagination. There are things that are in the Jewish tradition, however, that I find very compelling and I would even say beautiful. He died in 1572, but Rabbi Isaac Luria did some amazing things as he talked about the creation, and I'll share that with you right now. According to Rabbi Luria, 10 vessels were originally meant to contain the emanation of God's light, but they were unable to contain that light, so powerful was it. And they were hence displaced or finally shattered. As a result of this cosmic catastrophe, the values through which the cosmos was created are shattered and out of place, and the world in which we reside is composed of the shards of those broken values. I always think about the Kristallnacht, which was the real outbreak of the acts against the Jews, 1938 or 6. I just know that all of a sudden it was permissible to break the windows in Jewish shops in Germany. And Kristallnacht means the night of the breaking of the glass. And from then on, it was a very simple and short step to the final solution. In the creation of the world, similarly, these vessels are broken. Only 6 of the 10 are fully shattered, but that is, in fact, a catastrophe. If all of them had been shattered, the world would have been thrown back into its original chaos. But we only have the 3 highest remaining intact: will, wisdom, and understanding. These are broken. Spiritual, moral, aesthetic, and material values. These are in need of restoration or repair, tikkun. The breaking of the vessels is truly tragic. Will, wisdom, and understanding remain, but all the other values, especially those embodied in cultural and symbolic orders, have been shattered. So you see in this elegant, beautiful theory the whole nature of the human prospect and challenge. That we live in a world in which these divine emanations are available to us, but are broken. And what we are called upon to do is to engage in an act of continuous repair and maintenance, restructuring, refabricating the vessels, but to put back these vessels once broken into millions of pieces is truly a difficult and challenging mission. And yet that is the work of human beings, to repair, to try to restore. And what we have is will, wisdom, and understanding to bring against the chaos of the world. If you were to ask me, but do you believe that that actually happened? I would say it's a false question. Because, of course, I don't believe it actually happened. But isn't it so beautiful in its structure, in its understanding, in its reach, that you might say, no, it didn't actually happen, but it seems significantly true. Okay, Piper, are you ready? Okay, so let's just review. Okay, microphone's on. Let's just review a few things. Piper is a longtime member of our congregation and was set to sing last week, but it just didn't seem to coalesce. But I'm really pleased that she's here with us to sing today. And this wonderful song by Leonard Cohen has this interesting odyssey, because he writes it in 1984, puts it on an album, and people could care less. 1994, Jeff Buckley, musical genius, guitarist, vocalist, records Hallelujah and puts it on his only album. It's his only album because a few years later, swimming in a river in Tennessee, he drowns. And then in the movie Shrek, of all places, my gosh, the green ogre and all the craziness and the inventiveness of Shrek, out of nowhere seems to appear this incredible song. And people all over the world find it absolutely riveting because it's completely unexpected. The song, Leonard Cohen says, he has no idea what it's about. It has this interesting blend of biblical symbolism and sexual symbolism, and somehow it is a celebration of life. Hence the word which is repeated, Hallelujah. And it seems to me very fitting that Piper would share her beautiful voice and her music in this memorable song as we approach the end of our service. Are you good?